Hey, everybody. This is Charles Hand. Welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of November 5th, 2020. Although we are recording this on November 3rd, 2020. I'm Charles Hand, writer for No Film School. I am here with George Edelman, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
Hello.
And we are all joined by Oakley Anderson Moore, writer for No Film School.
Hey.
This week, we are going to be talking about the passing of a cinema legend. We are going to be talking about, you might not have heard about this, but in North America, they're having an election in the United States. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And we're going to wrap it all up with some tech news, some cold, apolitical, pleasingly calm technology news. Because
and very exciting also, worth mentioning. Stay for that, because if that's going to be good.
Very exciting. And you know what? People are going to argue with me about some of my opinions on the tech news, so we can get in arguments about it, but hopefully no one will call each other fascists. We'll see how it goes. All that this week on the No Film School podcast. All right. Our top story this week is the non-COVID related passing of Sean Connery. And that in and of itself is news in 2020. The fact that a cinema great of his generation managed to pass of natural causes.
He was 90 years old, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't he feel older in a way because he feels eternal? I mean, to me, it's like for audiences and fans, it's kind of like he's been out of the public eye for a while. He retired quite a while ago. His health has been in decline, and his wife, who survives him, mentioned that the last times were tough. You know, he was suffering from dementia, and he went in his sleep. And I think that, you know, living the 90 years that Sean Connery lived is a celebration of life situation. You could hardly do better. He passed peacefully, et cetera. But God, he looms so, so, so large. And we don't do obituaries on this podcast for every person involved in the industry who passes away, timely or untimely, but Sean Connery, well, one, it's been slow news outside of the election, but also Sean Connery is just a figure that goes beyond the medium, right? He goes beyond just being in movies, I think.
I also think that you have to, like, we're going to get, there's some darkness in Sean Connery, and don't think we're going to ignore that because we've got to acknowledge it. But before we talk about the darkness, I do want to say this is an industry in which people notoriously do not know when to leave. And he is the subject of a famous, like, of an obsession for a character in Trainspotting. And that character in Trainspotting is also obsessed with how people don't know how to leave. You know, Sick Boy's whole theory that life is good and then it's shit and that's it. And Sick Boy is, of course, obsessed with Sean Connery. And I do have to say that what's interesting about Sean Connery is he did make a decision about when to leave. He was offered a couple of sort of superhero movies. He passed on them because they weren't interesting. They were successful. Then he was offered League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He took it because he was like, well, I keep passing on these superhero movies and they're doing big. I should be in the superhero movie. And then it was a tremendous flop. And he was like, I don't get what's going on anymore. I'm out. I no longer understand the zeitgeist. Pop culture doesn't make sense to me anymore. My decisions aren't lining up with hits. And he retired. He was like, I can't make the calls anymore. And that in and of itself is an interesting and rare thing to sort of accept the changing of the guard. On the flip side, at the age of 57, totally defended slapping women in an interview with Barbara Walters, which, like, I don't know why his age is so important. People keep bringing up his age in regard to that interview as if, like, slapping women is something that, like, every 12-year-old boy thinks is okay and you should outgrow. Well, it's like at any age you should.
The full background on it, on the incident is that, yeah, he did a Playboy interview around the time of the Bond movies, which launched him into the stratosphere, as well as James Bond, the character. And it's just weird to think that, right? Like James Bond is a constant in the world, but Sean Connery created James Bond in that sense as much as James Bond created Sean Connery. They are both massive. Do you know what I mean? How weird is that? Just think, like, usually you get associated with a character or something, you're stuck. But like Sean Connery had a path divergent from the icon as an icon from the icon he created that continued to go. Anyway, that's just fascinating. But he, around that time, there was in the Playboy interview, they asked him, do you think it's okay to rough up or whatever, hit a woman in the way that James Bond does? Because those James Bond films were quite out of touch by today's standards. I mean, he was physically violent towards women. And he responded in a way that was like, basically, he said, yeah, you know, depending on the circumstance, et cetera, awful quotes, like unforgivable. And then Barbara Walters followed up on it when he was 57 and said, so you said this in the 60s Playboy interview, do you defend it? And he said, absolutely. You know, there's a time and a place where it's okay. And I condone it. And
as long as it's open fist, he did make that distinction, you know, not a closed fist, an open fist slap. So, you know,
yeah, he made it clear that he,
a horrible asshole.
Right. and
see, I never even heard on the any other of this. Hand, my Sean Connery image is completely ruined now after this podcast.
This is the thing. I mean, we're going to tread into this water more later. And it does. I do think it has to do with filmmaking, and it is relevant to our community and our podcast. But the world is full of complex and ugly situations and figures. And Sean Connery did some amazing things in terms of his work, and he did some awful things, it seems, as a human being. And he defended them in a way that's awful and unforgivable. And yet he is also this amazingly charismatic and unforgettable talent. And those things are hard to reconcile for us, but that's part of the challenge to me of being human, is that we have to reconcile that those things coexist, and we can choose to appreciate him or not. That's a choice everybody gets to make. We've talked about on the podcast before. Charles, you made a brilliant point in the past where it's like, there's a lot of movies and filmmakers for me to celebrate. I can choose to celebrate the ones that didn't commit, you know, sexual assault on minors, which is a choice that I stand by. Like so we can make decisions, and we can decide whether we want to say like, hey, I love James Bond, I love Sean Connery, or you know what, I can't enjoy it anymore because I know that he supported something that is just not okay. So I think we have to live with the complexity.
Also, cinema is political, but it's not like he was running for office. You know, he was an actor. He was like a creative artist. And so like, you know, and he wasn't the sole, like actors and directors are frankly different. Honestly, it's much harder for me. I mean, maybe this is insane, but it's much harder for me to watch a movie written, especially something written and directed by an abuser, because it just feels like this window into their mind. Like I haven't watched a Woody Allen movie in 20 some odd years, or maybe 15. It's been a while. No, actually more like 10. I was late to accepting how awful he was, but like, I'll probably still watch The Hunt for Red October again. Although Alec Baldwin has his own anger problems, you know.
Look,
because
if you tried to eliminate if you wanted to eliminate every movie or TV show that involves a person who's not a great person, you wouldn't have much left to watch.
Yeah,
because there's not a lot of great. Like, unfortunately, especially the further back you go, which I want to kick it over to you, Oakley. But I just want to add quickly, like, we also have to remember some context. I'm not defending any actions at all. I'm not condoning any actions at all. But I am saying that context is everything to me. And Sean Connery was born a very long time ago, 90 years ago, in poverty in Scotland. And the culture was different. And the world that raised him was different. And the what was accepted was different. And that doesn't mean it's okay, in my opinion. But I'm just saying that he comes from a different time and a different world. And hopefully we are in a different, better time and world. But part of that is because we don't tolerate that sort of behavior anymore. but I'm just think it's worth pointing out. It's different for that quote to come from Sean Connery in 1960, whatever, and 1987, than it is for it to come from, say, me in 2020.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I agree a little bit, but that's the same thing. Like, you know, anytime somebody like I kind of like Teddy Roosevelt. I've been out to his house. I'm a big Presidential Library nut. Like, and so like every once in a while, people will be like, well, yeah, Teddy Roosevelt said some really racist stuff in his letters, but like he was a product of the time. And I'm like, well, yeah, maybe he was a product of the time, but like go read John Brown. Like, you know, John Brown died before the Civil War started and was like wildly modern and progressive in views on race in a way that like was willing to die to end slavery. 100%.
No, there are founding, like, we have founding fathers who were very clear on the fact that this was 100% wrong. And there are others where we say like, well, they didn't know. It's like, well, they were around guys who knew, so they could have known. But I agree.
Beating
like,
your wife was wrong even in the 30s. I think. I wasn't there. But my guess is I still think it was, I mean, look, there's a little bit of like him being deliberately controversial, and there's a little bit of like him, like, yeah.
Okay. It's a complicated one. I mean, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, you know, hearing that he first said that in the 1960s, the 50s and the 60s in the US culturally was a time where masculinity really was changing a lot. This is something like that I talked to different historians for one of my documentaries, and I had no idea. I just assumed that from the foundation, our country was, you know, had a certain idea of what it meant to be, you know, a man. But that actually pretty changed pretty dramatically, like in the 50s and 60s. Earlier in the 1900s in the US, it was like, you know, there was these like class-based ideals that, you know, men of a higher caliber were more aristocratic and were less likely to like have muscles and be seen working. And that changed really dramatically in the 50s and 60s. So if we're looking at it from the sense of like Sean Connery being a product of the times, you know, in the 50s and 60s when he, you know, there was a big shift in films as well. Like the 20s and 30s was like the independent Katharine Hepburn cattle woman. And then the 50s and 60s, it was like, you know, the helpless Marilyn Monroe bombshells. And so Sean Connery fitting into what was going on, you know, doesn't make him necessarily admirable to just be a product of the world he was in. But there is this huge shift in you know, in being manly and macho. And, you know, you see all these movies of the time, men That's slapping women great, around. So, yeah. You know, it doesn't make him very exemplary to just be, you know, to say that in the 60s. But I can see that. I mean, people do, you know, and it's one thing, though, for then, you know, 20, 30 later, years later to be interviewed and still be like, yeah, it was fine what I said. Because I think people do make mistakes. And it's better if they say, you know what, that was wrong. I got to check myself. You know, I've just seen that, you know, hitting women is potentially problematic. But I don't know. Just so like Sean Connery, just in that sense, because I mean, he's just an actor who was good at his craft, but he was just a man and perhaps not an exceptional one in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. And what you remind me of by putting it in a timeline is like we can also, again, appreciate him as a piece of like our cultural history, because you reference Katharine Hepburn mm-hmm. and changing gender identity. And, yes. and film is a perfect place to look at that. And one of Katharine Hepburn's great co-stars was Cary Grant, who was the model for James Bond. And I always find this fascinating because Cary Grant, who I think people are pretty certain was bisexual, very possibly homosexual, but great regardless, an amazing actor, one of the greatest movie stars ever, hysterical, classy, like everything. And also a kind of a male ideal, like an ideal version of masculinity for that time. And so James Bond was written by, blanking on the name, someone, Ian Fleming. Right, yeah. with that character in mind, and they were like, well, we're not going to get Cary Grant, who's, you know, doing only the biggest movies right now to do this. But this guy's got a kind of Cary Grant vibe. And what's so fascinating is that Sean Connery really is like this extremely rough, like busting out of the suit, like can't quite contain him because he's kind of mm-hmm. animal-like version of Cary Grant, you know? And it works, like, but later they tacked James Bond in the other direction with Roger Moore. But But Connery was exactly the way you laid it out, Oakley, that version of a Bond, of a Cary Grant, that version of masculinity where it was like he's as likely to like kiss someone as he is to punch yeah. them, and like and it's dangerous and you don't know if you like it or trust it, and that, and he's a killer, you know, and all that is part of the mythology of Sean Connery, whatever we do with that, you know. But I mean, the man's just been, if you want to find just great, the industry poured out with, you know, stories about working with Sean Connery, and a lot of people have good ones. And one of my favorites was two writers on Twitter who you can find it just by Googling it or even checking the No Film School Twitter account. We retweeted it. They wrote the Ocean's 11 movie, the original, or not the original, the Steven Soderbergh one. And then they, among other movies, and they have this amazing Twitter thread where they talked about a script they worked on where Connery was attached to star, and he personally worked with them and gave them notes for a while, and it didn't end up working out. But their stories of interactions with him are just gold, and just like so many of the stories of people have about Sean Connery. If you love movies in the film industry and filmmaking, there's a lot of good ones with him out there.
It's also interesting what you talk about, Oakley, in terms of the changing concept mm-hmm. of masculinity, because like, you know, it's interesting to remember how mm-hmm. constructed it all is and why it was all constructed. Yeah. You know, 19th century men, there's lots of 19th century portraits of men holding hands. Like, it is not an uncommon thing at all. And still, if you go to Korea now, like lots of men over 50 will just like hold hands with their best friend. But, you know, after World War II, women mm-hmm. had been in the workforce. They wanted to get women back in the home and out of the workforce. So like this concept of masculinity that's a little bit exaggerated, I think, took hold deliberately to try and like reassert, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like things had started to change. Women were, and like, you know, in a way, Sean Connery is like an amazing like exaggeration of a certain concept of...
Yeah. Did the market overcorrect a little bit?
Yeah, I think so.
You know what? The middle class was really burgeoning for the first time in U.S. history after World War II. And in a way, the change in masculinity was kind of hand in hand with that, because all of a sudden it was like, well, there's a middle class. And we used to be considered nobodies in this country because there was no middle class. But all of a sudden we have a little bit of money and, you know, we're not upper class individuals. And masculinity became intertwined with this movement for the middle class to be there. And so like, you know, it was kind of like the more, you know, which would have been previously kind of like a vulgar display of masculinity, like that became sort of like entwined with, yeah, well, we're middle class. We're, you know, we're here and our ideals and values are just as good as the people, you know, in the upper 1%. It was like, you know, the masculinity was tied in like with the growth of a middle class, which all of a sudden meant, you know, people existed and people could voice who they were without having to just be struggling at the bottom as much. So, you know, everything's always so intertwined and complicated. So you could see Sean Connery representing every middle class guy who was told that, you know, he wasn't good enough or whatever. And all of a sudden he had a little money and he was like, yeah, Sean Connery, you tell him. And then he's like, yeah, you tell him, you know, slap that woman in the face. Like, oh, okay, well, come on guys, let's, you know, but you know, it's,
also, you bring up another great point about him, which is that he was dirt poor. Like he really did come from poverty, which, you know, is different than, I mean, there's a lot of stars and major figures in U.S. history who did, mm-hmm. but it does inform him and it informs his identity. And another interesting thing, and I think this crosses genders in terms of it being applicable, but also it crosses over into what you do as a creator in your career or anywhere in life. Sean Connery was a sex symbol without a doubt, but he was also, and I say this as a man who's been bald for a long time, always bald. He wore a toupee as Bond and he hated wearing a toupee. He actually preferred not to. So with every role, he was kind of like, I'd rather not, you know, that if I don't have to. And it didn't impact his sense of his masculinity or his ability to be sexy. And I bring it up because Sean Connery, as like in the parlance of like today, like didn't give a fuck. Like, I think he was very much like, I'm here, I'm me, this is what my accent's like, this is what my head looks like. Like, and you take it or leave it. I mean, he did wear a toupee when he had to, but like that energy.
And this will be my accent, whether or not I'm playing a Spaniard or a Russian.
Exactly.
It'll all sound exactly like
me.
Like,
he was like, you're on the Connery train or you're off the Connery train. Mm-hmm. And people like that. It's magnetic. And I think that there's something to be said for approaching whatever you are in life with that sort of like, hey, I'm here and this is me and I plant my flag in it. You know, like, like if you don't like what it is, like, you know, the idea of James Bond being like Cary Grant, who spoke in a very particular class affirming, even though Cary Grant also grew up poor. Connery was like, no, I'm Scottish. Like James Bond talks like this now. And I think that just like with Hunt for Red October, et cetera, et cetera. But like, again, he played, you know, he's only like, what, 13 years older than Harrison Ford. He played Harrison Ford's dad very well, but he chose the part in the Indiana Jones sequel. He was given the part of the bookish, not physically like imposing, nerdy, not adventure-y dad. And he took it and he played it and he was awesome and he was still Sean Connery. And he wasn't like, I'm not old enough to play your dad, you know, which is a thing actors will do or people in Hollywood will do. Like Sean Connery went against the grain in that sense. He didn't try to hide his age at any point and it worked for him. And I think that there's a model in that for us wherever we are in life.
I only really think of Sean Connery as the gray-haired man. You know, I didn't grow up on the Bond, on Sean Connery and Bond. And then once Sean Connery went gray, he went gray. And then he was that guy, you know, with the gray hair, but he played all the roles, you know, he filled each role in whatever way that role required, while looking, you know, a gray haired man.
Yeah. He was an old man and he didn't care. Like it didn't stop him from being in The Rock that he was like an old man.
Yeah. I mean, it is the definition of a movie star as someone who's just like preternaturally comfortable being themselves and like willing to bring that to a movie. Like there's charisma in that. And he did have and define a kind of movie star charisma. All right, moving on. Our next subject this week, if you haven't been paying attention, and seriously, someone hasn't, we're recording this Tuesday, November 3rd. You guys aren't listening to this before Thursday, November 5th. We don't know what happened as we record this. We don't know if a winner was declared on Tuesday night, although we don't think so. But there's an election happening today. Voting is happening all around us. I was out this morning with my daughter. There are lines all over Brooklyn as people wait to vote on the last day of voting. And we wanted to talk a little bit about filmmaking and elections. We wanted to talk a little bit about how this affects us as filmmakers, obviously, and what impacts it should have on the works that we create. And we also wanted to put some predictions out there so that all of you Thursday can laugh at us and how wrong we are, because you can't predict anything 2020, right? Like I could say, I think that an asteroid is going to hear me out. I think an asteroid is going to crash into a voting center in Florida, knocking a voter's hand to voting for a candidate, and Florida's going to be won by one vote, and we're going to have a court case about whether or not that asteroid affected the outcome of the election. And that's probably still not as ridiculous as what's going to happen today, because 2020, man, 2020. But
you guys
are all going to laugh at us on Thursday.
Yeah, there's so much here to tackle or discuss, and I think to try to give us focus on why we're talking about it on this podcast with this community. I just start by saying we've talked in this year quite a few times about the impact of elections, about the impact of civil unrest and protests and social justice and change. It's been quite a year. And that's not even talking about the global pandemic. This is election people are calling the most important election of our lifetimes. And it's definitely true. And I hope everybody's out there voting today. But for some focus in our community, I have been accused by both sides of the political spectrum for being too far on the other side at times on this podcast and on nofilmschool.com. And I actually think that's interesting because I think neither claims are completely unfair given the situations they were pertaining to, which is just to say, you know, there's been times where I came off as quite unwoke And I regret that and have corrected myself. And there were times when people said, you have a liberal bias. And that is true. Sometimes I do. And I think that that's sort of the state of the world. And everyone is sensitive right now to the situation. But one thing I'm particularly interested in is that whatever the outcome of today, and I certainly feel strongly that it should be a certain way for the betterment of humanity and its survival. And I'm not even joking, but whatever the outcome is, we will all have to move on and work and create and live and try to survive. And as filmmakers, we will encounter and work with people who have different views than us. Even though there is a stereotype of how the industry thinks, the industry is not a hive mind. I have a friend who's a set painter here in Los Angeles, and he's an extremely liberal individual. And the guys he works with are extremely conservative. And every day for 4+ years, like, they've been going to work and sharing the lunch table and, you know, working on big, big productions. And they couldn't be more far apart. And today will be another chapter in their struggle to maintain their working relationship. And I think that's true all over the country. And that's part of what, you know, we have to accept. Even in our little world of, like, you know, we're making movies today. We'll be making movies tomorrow, hopefully. And we will probably be doing it on sets with people who don't agree with us in a very polarizing situation.
So can I say the most ridiculous sentence that I'm going to say all year?
Yes.
Please.
I started to say this sentence and then I froze because I was like, I can't believe I'm about to say it, but I'm about to say it because, you know, podcast is about truth and honesty. Both my lawyer and my accountant, I suspect, are Republicans. And the fact that I just said my lawyer and my accountant, like Don Draper in 1963, just makes me feel totally ridiculous. But, like, you know, as you age, you develop relationships with lawyers and accountants. I'm pretty sure they're both Republicans. And we have managed to find a way to work it out. My accountant and I both hate Andrew Cuomo. I think we hate him from different sides. I think she hates it. But we both found some mutual agreement in our equal frustrations with that weird, pierced-nippled maniac. But yeah,
isn't it funny though, real quick, I want you to continue, I'm sorry to cut you off, but isn't it funny how there are these places where the far left and far right just see completely eye to eye, and sometimes it's someone who's in the middle who's, like, frustrating to everyone. Yeah. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, well, which is what's interesting about this election also, is that, like, I voted for Biden, I'm comfortable sharing that publicly, but Biden is not deeply beloved by anyone. Like, nobody's, you know, people have Obama tattoos. People, like, still talk about their love for Bill Clinton. There's, like, I've yet to meet anyone who's like, you know, when I saw, you know, people 4 years before Obama was the candidate, people were like, I saw him speak at the 2004 convention and I just knew. And I've been rooting, I've had his poster on my wall ever since. And, like, nobody feels like that about Biden. I like Biden. I feel warmly sort of towards him, but, like, he sniffs girls' hair. And he, like, proudly says he's not a socialist. And, like, he's this weird middle person where, like, it's real hard to be in the middle because no one likes you in the middle, right?
I think boomers like him, but yeah, continue.
Do they?
Well, my parents do, and they're boomers for sure.
But, like, legitimately love him? Because my parents are like, would have been Bernie and then would have been Warren and then are like, okay, fine, Biden, whoever.
Right.
Your parents legitimately are like, Biden is great. I like him.
Oh, yeah. No, my mom is like, it's funny. Yes. They're very, my parents are very, like, kind of middle of the road Democrats. Like, they're very, like, I'm left of them, but they are close. Yes. They really like him. And I think it's weird, but yes. They don't have tattoos or posters, though, which is a good point. Nobody probably does, which a lot of people do for Obama. But anyway, this is a side joke.
Yeah, do people have, like, Reagan tattoos? Oh, I just.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm yeah.
Probably,
I bet,
right?
I bet.
Tattoos, I mean, you know, they've changed a lot culturally.
That's a weird face for a tattoo, but yeah.
Maybe like an anarchy Reagan.
I mean, we all know Roger Stone has a giant Nixon tattoo. Like, they're people that are beloved. In a way that, as much as I'm rooting for Biden and hoping for Biden, he doesn't bring out that sense of, like, deep passion. Because, and this is how we wrap around to filmmakers, I remember a friend of mine made me a mixtape in high school and I loved every song on it but this one. And I was like, why did you put that song on it? It didn't fit. And she's like, oh, well, I wanted to make sure there was something on there you would like. And I knew you liked that band. So I put that on there as a safety. And it was the one that didn't fit. It was the one. And it was this real lesson for 15-year-old me that, like, it's just you got to do the – don't pander to your audience. Do the – it was this amazing, perfect mixtape of the tracks that she wanted to put on there. And as a filmmaker – at a certain amount, you should do the thing you want to do and people will embrace you and people will hate you. But trying to guess and to pander and to play out the middle of the road, you don't end up with people feeling as passionately about you. And you, and I think that Biden is a little bit of a, like, his instincts are very milquetoasty in a way that, like, I don't think makes for memorable cinema. Also, can we all agree how desperately nice it would be to have an election that wasn't the most important election in our lives? Like, when was the last time you were like, oh, this is a presidential election, but, like, neither side brings fascism.
The Clinton-Dole campaign of 1996.
Yes.
Extremely boring. And even though in hindsight and at the time I was young, I couldn't vote in that one. But I was very, like, you know, I wanted Bill Clinton to win. I'm a Democrat. I was raised that way. I was raised far left of center. But I remember thinking, like, the general vibe was just like, you know, like, this isn't a life or death kind of situation. Like, we're talking about, like, moving the, you know, because Clinton wasn't that far left either.
The 96 election is arguably the last one in which we're like, oh, this doesn't feel like a life or death decision, because Bob Dole, despite some questionable policies, it's like the last of the old school Republicans who is, like, probably not terrifically racist, would just like us to spend a little less money on things. And let's, you know, and also I was dating a Dole fan. Like, I successfully meant, like, the really, you know, it, like, she was for Dole, I was for Clinton, and it did not affect anything at all.
And whatever you think about Dole or Clinton, they weren't that far apart from each other on the spectrum, which is where things have changed so much. It's like, there really was a time not that long ago where you would be like, yeah, they're like, you know, there's some policy differences, but a lot of things that we don't like are going to be the same about both of them. You know, like, or conversely, if you're a middle of the road type person, a lot of things we do like are going to be the same. Whereas now it's just like, whoa, what planet is this guy from? And by this guy, I mean Trump. But anyway, Oakley, what were you going to say?
Yeah, Bob Dole was not going to put children in cages. Let's just agree on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I have really disliked about the past 4 years of the Trump presidency and about this election is just that everything has become so polarized and volatile, and everybody had their opinions before, but I do feel like, and if anything, what the president is supposed to do is be somebody who encourages us to be, like, the best version of ourselves. That's what, like, a leader is supposed to do, regardless of whether or not they do anything that actually affects your life. And so I do feel like this last 4 years, it's just brought out, it's just encouraged everybody to be the worst version of themselves, whether they are wholeheartedly a Trump supporter or, like, completely opposed to Trump. It's just the environment is one that encourages you to have with the two metaphorical, like, angels on your shoulder. There's one saying, punch that guy in the face. And that's, like, the one that is that's the angel that you're being encouraged to listen to. And that's why you don't have people who can have good conversations. You can't be dating there's no Biden supporter dating a Trump supporter. It's just, like, the environment is one that is, you know, pretty.
It's not fathomable right now.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of Democrats and liberals who really dislike Barack Obama. I know people on the right find that hard to believe, but I know plenty who really didn't like him and were dissatisfied with his presidency. But I will tell you one thing that he did that has nothing to do with politics that I always appreciated and valued about him was he was so good at keeping things civil and reasonable and respectful. And he kind of had to, because, you know, he's the first non-white president. So he had, just like Jackie Robinson had to for baseball, Barack Obama had to always be 10 times better. You know, it was just the bar he had to clear was so, so high. But he cleared it, and it set a model of how to interact. Even when Trump won, he was very like, this is what the American people chose. And and a lot of people were like, no, we're going to raise hell. And, you know, like, this is ridiculous. Stop him. It's like, no, this is what happens. This is how it goes. Like, and this is the deal. And I think that I would love us to return to that level of respectfulness just in public discourse, not calling for people's heads and not chanting to send people to jail and who have done not committed crimes.
Yeah.
When you yourself have, but that aside, I'm just so, everybody knows when they hear this, what happened or what's happening. And I encourage everybody to try to, well, also let us know, please. But like, cause this is a process. This is a group learning experience in no film school and in the world, but let's try to get back. We all are going to have to go back to work, et cetera, and into the world together and move forward on things that don't necessarily have, well, everything has politics, but things that aren't fixated around this presidential election for certainly. And that's challenging. And we have to find ways to do it. Like whatever happened Tuesday, like how are you coping with the people you know in the world who disagree with you? And, you know, there are also for creators, and I want to hear what both of you think about this. I think there are lots of overtly political films and social films, but there are ways you can make statements that are universal and impactful, but not overt. And I think there are, I'd like to see film. I think film has done it. Television has done it. But I think if you have something to say, say it in whatever way you want to. But whatever happened on Tuesday, like find ways to put it into your work. You know, when Elia Kazan made On the Waterfront, which is like the 1954 Oscar-winning classic. If you haven't seen it, it's amazing. He was addressing the issues of communism and the hearings that were being held and the pointing fingers and the blame game and the outing people and the blacklisting and all of that. That was a major shakeup in 1950s in the United States of America. And in that movie, which was about dock workers, right? It was not about those issues exactly. He told his story and he defended his position, whether you agree with it or not, so cleverly. And I think that's something that you can do, whatever your politics or social views are, you can tell stories about them without it being that tell stories metaphorically and capture your point of view and become great movies. And people who watch them won't necessarily even know, but they'll get your message. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's that because you're really touching on something about what the point of making films is. And as filmmakers, I feel like if you're really genuinely, truly passionate in the art form, then you're not interested in just making propaganda. Or
right.
Which is like, I mean, unless you've been hired to make commercials for
you can do that too.
But we're trying to get at something that enters into this discussion of who we are and what is it like to be a human being in our culture. And all those things are so much more interesting than just deciding your, you know, then this sort of like partisan, when you say films are political, I mean, they are in such a more interesting way than what we're talking about when we say political on election day. It's like this very,
yes,
you know, uninteresting and narrow-minded idea of what politics is because it's an election between party A, party B. And like films are so political, much more so than you're getting in any of this discussion of what the candidates running for president told us about, which is not a knock on the candidates, just this particular environment. But yeah.
Yeah. Like every movie, like we've talked about, I know Charles, I want to get back to hear what Charles has to say about all of this, but that we talked about cop shows and the role of cops in our television and movie history and what, how that sends a message. Or like, if you have a thought about law enforcement, why don't you tell a story about a cop that addresses your point of view about it? That isn't necessarily about the events that took place this year. You can do that too, but you can also tell a story that's just about the nature of law enforcement that addresses the issues you think are interesting.
Yeah. And like in documentary, this is something like documentary filmmakers are always working with. It's like they're constantly trying to show a point of view or a character that isn't necessarily their own. And like the films, doc filmmakers, there are some who are exploitative and, you know, will portray their characters in a light that is skewed to advantage their perspective. But many documentary filmmakers, the goal is to give an honest portrait of someone. And that means not necessarily sharing the beliefs of your subjects, you know, that's something that I know film school we've covered a lot. Like, how do you make a story about somebody who don't share their opinion, you know, without making it a chop job? And it's, we do it all the time, and people are really good at doing this. Talented, interesting filmmakers. We have found ways to do this in the past, and hopefully we can find ways to do it in the future after we find whatever the results of the election are.
Charles, are you still there? Did we lose you?
I'm still here. Yeah, I just don't, I mean, I guess the only other thing that I wanted to talk about was the fact that, like, so many of our expectations for what this week looks like are mediated. So, like, you know, a lot, I didn't know until recently that before 1952, there was no expectation that you would know the results of an election on election day. That the idea that you would know the results that day were created by television networks. I believe it was NBC at the time who worked with the UNIVAC, which was an ad, like the UNIVAC Corporation, the company that made the UNIVAC, like, cut a deal to NBC if they, you know, partly to promote the computer to business customers that would tabulate the results in real time of the night.
Crazy.
And before 1952, in the 1948 election, there was no expectation that anyone would know the night of the election. And so, like, media creates these expectations. And so as people who create media, we should think about what kind of expectations we want to create. Like, for instance, I want to stop calling it early voting. Like, why can't we just have a 2-week voting window and we just call that voting? Like, that's voting. You have 2 weeks. You can go anytime in those 2 weeks. It's not, you're not going in early if you go 2 weeks. That's like, you know, like, there's still this, you know,
you're
polls
right.
Have been open for
when
2 weeks.
When we say early voting, it's almost like we're talking about it like we cheated a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like,
like second, no, the voting polls were open, or something.
Yeah. And it's like, it's not early. We have a 2-week window. You can turn it in whenever you like. And there's this, like, thing that we get from college or high school or whatever of, like, you know, of, like, a thing is only really due at its deadline. And if you turn in your paper a day early, you're like a suck up or whatever, or goody two shoes. Although the biggest drinker in my college always turned in all of his work early. And he was like, yeah, you guys are insane. Just do your work during the day and then you can drink like you want at night.
Was
like,
that
why
you?
Would you ever do a paper at night?
Just joking.
No, but he and I drank together at night a lot.
A true dedication.
Good guy.
To alcoholism.
Yeah, but he was like, why would people ever write their papers the night before it was due? That's just stupid. You should be drinking the night before it's due because you already turned it in. And I, savvy guy, really knew how to party. So, like, we should, you know, I'm going to stop saying early voting. I'm just going to talk about the, you know, 2-week voting window. And, like, I think it's important to remember as media makers that, like, we get to set expectations. We get to choose what we use for language. All of these are choices that are being made. And we get to make those choices, too, as we set out to create whatever media we want to create. I mean, science fiction has drifted a little bit in the last few years into being mostly action-based, but the original goals of science fiction were to imagine what a world could be. Like Star Trek, to speak of another very comfortable bald actor, you know, Star Trek was set to imagine, it was less about imagining technologies and more about imagining progress in our civilization. And, like, that's what's so exciting about sci-fi when it's good. Is you see ideas about what civilization might look like organized in different ways. And that's what remains so exciting about some sci-fi that isn't just, you know, 90 minutes of alien fights, which also can be really fun. Don't
yes.
get me wrong. But, like,
and you can have both.
You know, yeah, you can have both. You can have the alien fights.
I miss sci-fi as a metaphor, and I certainly love that Star Trek always quested to, well, probably not recently, but in the past, to tell a story about a future that was the best version of ourselves.
Yeah.
We could really use some of that for anybody who wants to try it. It's hard to do, I think, but it's a noble effort. There's so well said. You mentioned Don Draper earlier, and I think you reference him again because as media creators, we get to do something. He famously, the character mentioned, which is change the conversation, dictate the narrative. If you don't like, I think he says something like, if you don't like what people are saying, change the conversation or something like that. But that's what you do as a creative in media, a media maker, a content creator, a filmmaker. We get to be a part of what dictates what the conversation is. Do you want to change how we talk about? I mean, Charles, you do it all the time. You say like, I don't think we should say one man band. I think we should say one mule team or something. Like, yeah. Changing the language is powerful. Changing the what we reference and how we talk about it and how we craft the stories around us, because that's what we're all doing, whether we're filmmakers or not. It's a good point. And we will have a lot of opportunities to do that, whatever came last Tuesday.
I mean, look, statistically, you listeners probably don't know the official results of this election either. Let's be real. So let's just roll with that. This is my last wrapping it up around into filmmaking. Most of a filmmaking career is getting comfortable and living in the unknown. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like you graduate from college and you get a job at Filmco, and Filmco is like, okay, you're going to get to make a movie every 3 or 4 years, and you're going to be on salary, and there's a 401k, and there's like, and you're like, okay, and you know,
Now you've created a true utopian fantasy for me, which is Filmco.
Oh my God.
So that's my Star Trek is Filmco.
Filmco.
Somebody asked, I can't remember what interview it was, but somebody asked P.T. Anderson about how long it took to get, There Will Be Blood made, and you know, and he's like, and his quote was, it was better said because P.T. Anderson's brilliant, but it was like, it's not like when I set out to make this, I knew it was going to be 6 years to make another movie. It just sometimes takes 6 years to get a movie made. Like, that's just like, like everything about filmmaking is a process of living in the unknown. I mean, I've had friends, this hasn't happened to me. The closest I've had a project canceled to shooting is a couple months out. I've had friends who had the project canceled the day before shooting was supposed to start. Like, that happens. That is part of our career. I've heard a story, although I don't know this person, of someone who woke up the day of first day of production and it was canceled. That seems like the worst thing ever. But we all know the feel. I mean, you know, if you've worked around any movies, we all know that feeling of being like an hour into the first day shooting and being like, oh, okay, this is happening. We're like an hour in, like we've done a couple shots. Like, it's the likelihood of it getting canceled. It's like a flight, right? Like, they say a flight always, you know, crashes on takeoff and landing. And once you're in the air, you should relax. It's like about halfway through the first day, you're like, okay, statistically, we're probably going to get to finish shooting this.
I've been on some of those flights that crashed, man. That's no fun either.
Yeah.
No, so that can happen too. Yeah. You could be on a project or have a project going and I was quite a ways in when it, but it was probably mostly my fault, but another story for another time, but it happens, you know, it happens.
But our career is one that teaches us with how to live in the unknown. And I think that America is practicing living in the unknown this week. And so if you're a filmmaker who's lived your life as a freelance pirate, you know, because the film industry is full of people that would have been pirates 400 years ago. Because, like, we're, you know, we couldn't hack it in normal life.
Let's be honest.
Yeah. You should provide comfort to the people in your life who are used to more certainty and predictability. I think a lot of America really wanted answers this week on Tuesday night. My guess is there were not answers on Tuesday night. My guess is that there's a lot of unknown, and learning to stay calm in the unknown and keep moving forward in the unknown is something I think every filmmaker has in their toolkit, and everybody should be practicing this week.
I like that.
All right. Should we do tech news now?
Yeah.
Uncontroversial. No one should call us a fascist. No one, over our opinions on tech news. So tech news this week, we actually already talked about this camera in tech news like 3 months ago when it came out, but the company that made it was nice enough to loan it to us for 2 weeks, and we shot a bunch of fun tests with it. So I want to talk again in tech news. It's a big review. It might be the longest thing I've ever written for No Film School. It's really long, but there's a lot of pictures in between because I like pictures breaking up the text. It actually got broken into two articles. It was so much. Review of the Blackmagic 12K camera. Woo. Huge, huge, huge thing. So a little bit of context. Blackmagic Design is a company out of Melbourne, Australia. remind me not to do accents. Like, at the beginning of every episode, George, I just want you to say, and no accents, Charles, and I'm recording.
I just like that you did it on one word because it sounded good on the one word. So you didn't have to string together multiple.
Yeah. That's all you get out of me, folks. They, you know, run by a very smart guy, Grant. I interviewed him a couple years ago at NAB. Really nice guy. Big nerd. We had a lot of, like, it's one of my most fun interviews because we just really nerd out on vintage filmmaking technology from the 80s and 90s, like video making stuff. He's fascinating. And they own DaVinci Resolve. They've been making cameras for 8 or 10 years now. And their cameras are very popular in like an indie world. You know, the Blackmagic Pocket 4K and the Pocket 6K sell like hotcakes. They are everywhere. They're huge hits. We post things about them. They get a lot of traffic. Our 6K video, Ryan, the founder of the film school, took it to Burning Man and it like did very, you know, everybody wanted to see footage of the Pocket 6K and Burning Man. And, you know, they're famous for a lot of things, but you know, heartbreakingly, they haven't really been able to break into the top end of imaging. You know, and the example that comes to mind is there was a great music video. I don't write a lot of these articles of like how they did this music video shot, but there was a really cool one-shot music video last year or the year before that was all in a car. And so I did write the behind the scenes for it. We should include it in the show notes because it was fascinating. And in the behind the scenes video, you can see they did like a week's worth of testing all on the Blackmagic. And then on the day, there was this complicated rig. They like pull the Blackmagic Ursa they had out of the rig and they put in a Red. And you're like, you know, they were a camera that like, because you could buy an Ursa, they're like bigger, more pro camera for like $4,000 or $5,000. It was a camera like a lot of production companies would own and do all their tests and all of their pre-pro on. But then on the day, you're renting an Alexa or a Red because you want better low light or you want better color reproduction or you want something like that. It sort of lived in that space. And which is interesting because they own Blackmagic Resolve, which is a color grading software. So you would think they would have a lot of color experience, but Red and Alexa really still owned that top of the cinema space. This summer, they announced the Blackmagic 12K, which if you're counting Ks, that's 12 Ks, which is 12,000 pixels across. And you'll notice if you're paying attention to the market, nobody else has 12K. There's a couple people. Sony has an 8K. Canon has an 8K. Red is at 8K for 4 or 5 years now, but nobody else had gone to 12K.
It's an interesting way, right? The bear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not bear. So everybody else uses this one sensor pattern called bear, which is red, green, and blue pixels. But their 12K sensor is not bear. It's a different pattern. It's a symmetrical pattern. So there's 2,000 red pixels, 2,000 green pixels, 2,000 blue pixels, and then 6,000 clear white pixels for low light sensitivity. So it's a whole new sensor design that we don't actually know exactly how it's laid out, although there's patents online filed by people who work for Blackmagic. So we're pretty sure those patents are the right layout. And it opens up all of these cool new possibilities. So the first thing I have to say, I shot with it for 2 weeks and it looks great. Like the footage, I was like, oh, I would like to shoot jobs on this. Like, I feel like it's like cool. The color science is legitimately like, oh, yeah, this looks really nice. Skin tones look good right out of the camera. Fleshed in neutral is really nice. It looks saturated without looking digitally saturated. Like, you know, it's the brand new Blackmagic Color Science 5. And I'm like, oh, legitimately with the 12K guys, you guys are in the running. Like, I could see, you know, as opposed to previously, where like everything I did ended up on Red or Alexa, and honestly, mostly Alexa, unless there was a compelling reason to be Red. I actually think there are jobs where I could consider the 12K in competition.
Why would it be better? Really, in what under what circumstances? I think what would you prefer it? What were the
advantages? So I right now I don't know if I would view it as an advantage as a rental item. I think if I'm doing a job where I'm renting, I'm probably still going to go out and rent Alexa Mini or a Classic because you can still afford them so much. But I think this is a really interesting camera for an owner operator. And here's why. With most cameras, if I buy an 8K camera and I want to shoot it in 4K, you know, like if I bought an 8K Red and I want to shoot it in 4K, I have to window down in the sensor. And what that means is all of my lenses change their field of view. So my wide lens is now a long lens and I need a, you know, my 18 millimeter in 8K is still an 18 millimeter in 4K, but now instead of giving me a wide shot, it's now giving me a close up. If I need a wide shot, I need like an 8 millimeter, which is an expensive lens, or, you know, so you need to rent more lenses to switch resolutions, or you need different sets of lenses. It's just not convenient. Because it's a symmetrical sensor, you can shoot 12K, 8K, 6K, 4K, all full sensor, and they all look great. So I think this camera actually is kind of interesting for an owner operator because like you go out and shoot an indie feature, you probably shoot 12K because why not? You're only going to shoot for 2 weeks. The indie feature can afford the hard drives and you just deal with it in post. But let's say you're going to go shoot a doc and the doc wants to shoot hundreds of hours of interviews over a week. Well, you could just switch that to 4K, because it's still going to look great. The 4K footage still looks phenomenal.
And you're saying but, ultimately your lens package can be unchanged because of
and you're exactly
serve the same purpose on any job. So if you have a lens, exactly. So you're saying versatility, basically.
Huge versatility benefits of, you know, like that 4K footage is going to be easier to edit, easier to post, smaller hard drive footprint, way more useful, but it's still all the lenses you own are going to give you the same field of view they would give you in 12K. That 4K footage also looks phenomenal. 4K is still a phenomenal format to finish in. And it can shoot 4K up to 120 frames per second. If you go down into Super 16 mode, which does window the sensor into the small little part of the sensor, you can shoot 4K 240 frames per second. So you have like a real slow-mo monster.
Even and what's the price? What's the price point right now?
$9,995. So like a very competitive price, not as cheap as the Red Komodo, which is coming in at 6,000, but as opposed to the Red Komodo, which I know a bunch of people are buying, like three people I know are going to buy Komodos, but the Komodo is really like, it was originally designed to be like a crash cam. It doesn't have full-size audio inputs. It doesn't have, you know, it's like very much a tiny little thing that's like designed to be the smallest footprint possible. Whereas the 12K is in the full Ursa mini body.
Right. And it's the camera brain, yeah. Right? It doesn't come with all the things yes. You need to get. Yeah. It's more like having a brain exactly. And not the whole body. Yeah.
Whereas the Ursa mini body, which is what the 12K is in, you know, it has, you'll need to buy batteries, but it has, you know, battery connectors and power connectors and SDI ports and all of the stuff. You'll need a viewfinder too, but, you know, it's the same body they've been making for 5 years. So if you have a 4-year-old or some mini, you can move that viewfinder on over to this one. There's used viewfinders available. There's all sorts of flexibility and stuff.
I'm interested in this. I have another question follow up. If you,
bring them,
what do you think? So, you know, I'm sold. I'm going to click the link in our podcast description where we'll put an affiliate so you can go buy it at Autorama or whatever, or Amazon. And then I'm thinking like, okay, how am I going to make back or pay off the credit card debt now of $10,000 or whatever? What do you think you can rent it for? What do you think the rental will be on a day?
So first off, if you're buying equipment, you should never use your credit card. You should talk to an equipment leasing company because you can usually work out some sort of like 4-year dollar buyout lease where you still get to keep it when you're done, but the interest rate will be way better because it's secured by the equipment. So like,
that's a great pro tip for everyone out there. Yeah.
Yes.
See, my hypothetical filmmaker was about to do something stupid and Charles just saved him.
But I could get a free flight by never using put my it credit on a credit card.
Well, there's that too. Yeah. No, I mean, that's
yeah, sure, but that free flight is not going to, you know, when you're paying 20% on the credit card, the free flight is not worth it. Talk to an entertainment leasing, like an equipment leasing specialist, you know, because there's so many people out there. Like, if you run a small business, don't buy phones. Like, when you're installing your phone system, talk to an equipment leasing company, like, and do a dollar buyout lease at the end of your 4-year term. You pay a dollar, you get to keep it if you want to keep it. But, like, oh, such a better interest rate. You can get a much more aggressive interest rate than a credit card. So I don't actually like the rental rate body only. It's $10,000. You're probably looking at like $300 to $400 a day body only. And that's, you know, assuming a 2-day week or something. So if somebody's keeping it for a weekend, you're charging 1 day. If they're keeping it for a week, you're charging 2. So a weekend rental for just the body.
Not including anything else you have in the package.
Yeah, but I'm assuming you build a full package. You get a nice set of lenses. You get a nice tripod. You get a bunch of accessories going. You're probably looking at an $800 weekend package, is my guess. I actually didn't look and see. I mean, there's so few out there. They wouldn't be on ShareGrid or Kitsplit now, but that is sort of my guess. So, you know, you're looking at, like, let's say a $10,000 camera body and $10,000 in accessories, $20,000. You're looking to pay that off. You're looking, let's say, 30 rentals. So 30 rentals is a lot of work, but over 2 years, you could probably do 30 rentals. And so, and remember, because of the flexibility of the system, a wider array of rentals open up to you. There's indie features where this is going to be the right camera. And then there's going to be dock jobs where this is going to be the right camera. There's going to be corporate industrial.
See,
stuff
led me down this rabbit hole of questions for you, because I started thinking, if the advantage is that you can really simply swap out the same, you know, the same kit, the same lens, everything for whatever type of project you're doing, then it's like, well, whatever kind of filmmaker you are, you can make this kit available that pays for itself to people who do all different kinds. You could wedding videographers. Like, you could do anybody who's, which Oakley has been,
yes,
and could advise on. But, like, you could do all kinds of things. You could make docs. If you're like Oakley, you make docs. You could do a web series if you're Charles. So, like, that flexibility means, like, well, if I was going to get one, because I'm always thinking when we talk about these new cameras, there were so many released this year. If I was going to get one to actually be owner operator and try to pay off, what would my smart move be? And this seems like it would be a very smart move.
I mean, the biggest risk you run into is reputational. Right now, most of your clients
are going to want an Alexa. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is still the reality that we live with, is the reputation for the Alexa is so strong because, frankly, the Alexa looks great. It's an amazing camera. It looks beautiful, phenomenal work. I think the Blackmagic 12K, there's a lot of reasons why 12K is a weird thing to call it, but I love that they're hitting 12K so hard because I do think that marketing will actually benefit them. I think people will hear of it. I think some clients will want it just for the 12K-ness of it, but I also think that, like, the color and imaging and the low light capabilities are a real leap forward for Blackmagic, and that some really nice looking footage will come out of it that will help reputationally. But yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing. I mean, in the end, I'm always a little nervous about saying, like, you want to do the math of how many rentals you can get, because rentals are obviously one way we all pay off our gear, but also you want to get the camera that's going to be the closest to what you want to do jobs on, and then hope that rental income supplements that. It's also really tricky because we just had a pandemic, and I'm assuming no one rented anything on ShareGrid or Kitsplit for March, April, or May.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I think it's back. I think people are working again, but it is a weird, it is like a, don't stretch yourself too far. Like, never put yourself in a position where you couldn't make your monthly lease payment without the rental. In our dream scenario, you're making your monthly equipment lease payment by doing two rentals. You know, like, if your lease payment is $1,000 a month and you do two rentals and that gets you to $1,200, hooray, your lease is free. But you should be in a position where you can afford that lease payment if another pandemic happens, because things do come up. There are ebbs and flows in this industry. And so I think, you know, being a little bit more conservative is probably fair. The other thing about the Ursa Mini is it's not going to be a stabilizer. I mean, the 12K is, it's not, like, if you want to put it on a stabilizer, you need the full-size Ronin 2. You can't put it on a Ronin S. It is, as opposed to, like, the Komodo or the C70, which are smaller bodies, which are going to fit on a Ronin S or other small stabilizers, other small sliders, the Ursa Mini is, like, a full-size camera. Even though it has Mini in the name, it's not really Mini. I wish, like, my most controversial take is I wish Blackmagic would change their naming. Because the pocket cameras... Well, the pocket cameras no longer fit in your pocket. They're too big, so they shouldn't be called the pocket cameras anymore. The Ursa Mini is called a Mini, but it's actually the biggest thing they still commonly make. They do right. Technically make an Ursa,
it
which
is misleading
bigger, but
that
one,
thing's called a Mini. I would agree. That confuses me, and
which
I'm
is
a
the
layman.
Biggest, yeah, it's like, just call that the Ursa. Call the Ursa
Biggie or something.
Or the Ursa Major, which would actually be
referencing. Don't hire me. Also, don't hire me to come up with names, clearly.
I like Ursa Major.
I don't know. The Biggie's not bad.
It's not bad.
Ursa Major, right?
Yeah.
And then, yeah. Yeah. That's my hot take for Blackmagic. Yeah. I will also say this. If you are thinking about this camera, there's going to be a 12K pocket. I'm betting. I have no inside information. There's no leaks or anything. But, like, they have the sensor. The pocket sells like hotcakes. It'll probably be 5 or 6,000, and you won't have the crazy slow-mo that you get out of the Ursa Mini, and you won't have the full-size audio connectors, and you won't have, like, you know, the pocket camera's fun, but everybody, like, the pocket camera's actually kind of a nightmare to shoot, like, 12-hour days on set with, because you have to have external batteries, and, like, the pocket camera is, like, it's a different space. But if you're a pocket camera user, and you're, and you've gotten used to working around the limitations of the pocket, I bet IBC 21, which is what, next September, which is not that far away. I bet by IBC 21 we see a pocket 12K or like a pocket 8K, but it's the symmetrical sensor or whatever. So I think that go Ursa if you're like, I work 12-hour days on sets and I'm used to having a full crew and I'm used to audio interfaces and I'm used to powering my accessories and all that stuff. You need the Ursa Mini. But if you're like, oh, Pocket has totally treated me well in my life and for the jobs I do, I think a 12K Pocket will probably come. I could be wrong, but that is my guess. All right.
Very cool.
I think that's our show this week. Good luck to everyone in the future living in the unknown, unless maybe there's some miracle and Tuesday night was a crazy, like such a crazy landslide that everybody knew Tuesday night, but I'm assuming we're all living in the unknown. Well, let's plug our pluggables. You can always check me out at charleshain.com or on Twitter and Instagram at charleshain, or you can check out my new web series. If you want to watch something that has nothing to do with our current election, you can check it out at saltypirate.tv. And if you watch it on Amazon, give me a rating, give me all the stars because it helps the algorithm or something. Feed the beast.
I'm Oakley Anderson Moore. Thanks for listening. You can follow me on Instagram at Oakley Louise, where I post occasionally. I mentioned before that Brave New Wild, my feature documentary, is on playing across the country in public television, but it is also on iTunes and Vimeo Pro. So if you use those, then yeah, do the same for me. Go watch it and give some ratings. And we're going to have a cool article coming soon on No Film School about how to become a COVID-19 compliance supervisor. So it could be a sweet new gig for somebody listening. And if you haven't read it, a recent article interview on the site is all about the filmmakers of Residue, which is one of my personal favorite stories of late, about a director and a DP straight out of school who met at a cafe and 3 days later shot a feature that got picked up by Ava DuVernay and is now on Netflix. So check out that interview.
Damn.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that
sounds great.
Living the dream.
What's
right?
This No Film School site you're talking about?
Yeah, so nofilmschool.com. I think if you just type in, I forget the exact headline, it's about how Residue filmmakers greenlit themselves. So look for that.
We will share it in the show notes for sure.
Yes.
That's great. And yeah, I'm George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School. And thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Oakley and Charles, for being here. And yeah, there's like all the things we talked about and more on nofilmschool.com. Oakley and Charles are regular contributors and have been for a long time. And there's tons of great stories they've covered, tech and otherwise, over the years. Please also like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast and leave us the comments and let us know what you think. Let us know that you hate my politics one way or the other. Everybody else lets me know at editor@nofilmschool.com or ask@nofilmschool.com. We appreciate all of you. I hope you all go out and vote. And I hope you're all having a great week and hang in there. Thanks so much.